Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined as always on the show by Peter Flaherty. How's it going, Peter?
I'm doing well. It's Halloween today, not Halloween when you're listening to this. It's weird. It's kind of like one of the only holidays that I feel like kind of has an expiration date, so it just feels like a Thursday, but it is Halloween.
You told me it was Halloween. I literally put zero thought into it being Halloween today because in apartment life, like, sometimes you're just not in a place where people do anything about it. Like, I'm not a big Halloween fan, independent of like any like other friends and family. So like, it was completely not on my radar. I had completely forgotten today was actually Halloween. So I guess happy Halloween, Peter.
Yeah. Happy Halloween. I went down to CVS, treated myself to like, I went trick or treating at CVS. I got a,
with a bunch of shots.
Yeah. I got a peanut M&Ms. Like mini Airheads and then Kit Kats. So
wait, so you got this? You got this candy for yourself, or this is what you're handing out tonight?
Oh, I got it for myself. I went trick or treating in like aisle three of my CVS.
Okay, this is tremendous. I might have to like yoink that Halloween adult draft strategy and just like go get some Kit Kats and Reese cups for myself. That sounds amazing.
Oh yeah, to hand out, it's the usual. it's like that classic like box of assorted Hershey's products, so it's like Hershey bars, Reese's, M&M, just like very like solid candies, nothing extravagant in two out of the box.
All right, do you know what I just thought of? No, sorry, go ahead, I cut you off.
Oh no, you go for it.
Now finish, because I want to take us into a different direction once you're done.
I was gonna say I like to keep it like somewhat simple. I'd also be afraid to be known as like that one house that like to be a house known for things, like, if that makes any sense, like
the house simple. Everyone wants to go to. Yeah,
not even that, just the house that like doesn't have like dots or like Tootsie Rolls or anything like that.
We should do a Halloween candy draft is what I was thinking when you were talking about this.
Oh, that'd be a good one. I feel like around Thanksgiving we'll do another
dish draft. Let's just do your like, what's your 80 grade Halloween candy if you could only pick one? Who's your one pick?
I'll keep it sort of simple. I've loved Kit Kats forever.
Yeah, like honestly,
that's an eight for me.
I really am torn between the Reese's and the Kit Kat, but I feel like I find myself getting a Kit Kat more if I'm getting like candy at a convenience store or something, and I just want some chocolate or something. I feel like I tend to go towards Kit Kat, and I don't know if it's because Reese's does this thing where they've got like 15 different variations of Reese's, and sometimes it's hard just to find like the regular peanut butter cups.
Reese's recently has gone like
they're going nuts.
Big cup, yeah, no pun intended, like big cup. Fast break is actually really good, but I'm also I might be a pieces over cup guy at the end of the day too, which is
A hot take. That's my
hot
like,
take.
They're like Spencer Schwellenbach or Yu Darvish with just a really deep pitch mix. They can come at you with a lot of different things, and it's all pretty effective. So, but we are here to talk about more than just candy today. We're going to start our draft review series for the 2024 draft class. I was looking at our podcast for this a year ago, and right before we hopped on here, I was telling Peter I didn't realize how early we did the draft reviews after the 2023 class. I'm kind of glad we're doing them later this year, just because earlier this week we released our draft report cards for all 30 teams. So it's superlatives for each draft class in a bunch of different categories. We get the chance to see the few players who are activated after the draft, see what they do in small samples. So I think there's probably more to talk about at this stage. But as I'm talking this through, I think last year one of the issues for me is it's always hard to like review a draft after it happens. You kind of do the draft and immediately go on to the next one. So I think that was part of the thought process, but I am curious if you guys like have a preference for when we kind of take a look back at the draft after it happens on the pod. I think there are probably pros and cons to doing it earlier and later. Like it's more of like just what your personal preferences are, but I do feel like we've gotten more time for these classes to kind of sink in. And I guess since the World Series is officially over now, we are officially in the off season. So it makes sense to do it at this stage for me this year.
Yeah, likewise. It was funny when you brought it up beforehand, how we apparently did it super early. For some reason, it felt like we did it almost later than we're doing it now. But nonetheless, I'm excited to, I guess, circle back a little bit.
Yeah, so let's get into it. Today we're going to be doing, and if you clicked on the show, you probably know, we're doing AL East draft classes review, and we're just going to kind of talk through each draft class, maybe talk about draft strategy, talk about picks we liked, maybe some picks that we're a little more skeptical of, some players that are off to hot starts, and we'll just go alphabetical order in here and start with the Orioles. So on their initial draft review that was published like a few days after this draft, the draft theme I put on this class was premium position bats. The Orioles were picking number 22 overall in the first round. They took Vance Honeycutt in the first round. They had a PPI pick at number 32 for Gunnar Henderson. They took Griff O'Farrell with that pick. They continued to go college hitter with their next few picks, Ethan Anderson, a catcher out of Virginia, then Austin Overn, an outfielder out of USC. In the fourth round, they took Chase Alsup, right-handed pitcher out of Auburn, and with their fifth round pick, they took Cal Poly catcher Ryan Stafford. Peter, any overall thoughts on this class, kind of as a thumbnail overview before we get into some specific players?
Yeah, I'm a fan of it in general. I really like the college theme, unsurprisingly. And the Orioles do a great job, I think, both of evaluating in the lead up to the draft and in the draft itself. And then I think what takes a lot of their classes over the goal line is their ability to develop. And we see it, you know, especially in the last couple of seasons with the homegrown talent that has come up through the system. And I think that this year's draft has a fun blend of high upside guys, especially in the first few rounds that, that we'll get into a little bit more. And then also some, I guess, arms in particular in the later rounds that also have a chance to pop.
Yeah, the Orioles in recent years have really just been completely unshy about taking polarizing college outfield profiles as Enrique Bradfield in 2023. There are big questions about, like, does his power play in the first round? Then with Vance Honeycutt, we talked about him ad nauseum. There are real hit risks, but in terms of just like secondary tools, athleticism, profile, he probably has like the highest pure upside in the draft class. It's like him and Connor Griffin, take your pick. And in terms of if they hit, they're going to be superstars. The early returns for Vance Honeycutt have not been super great. It's only a 56 plate appearance sample, but seeing that 42.9% strikeout rate with him is kind of the concern. That is the question mark moving forward. It was the big bugaboo with him in college. If that wasn't a question mark, the Orioles probably aren't getting him at 22 and signing him for $4 million. He's probably signing for like $6 million plus and going inside the top 10 picks. So it's kind of like an acquisition cost question. Like, clearly, like, you're more than happy to take the risk as Baltimore getting an athlete like this in the 20s, whereas maybe you just can't stomach that sort of hit risk in the top 10. That's kind of why they got him where they did. But another player who has some similarities, I think, to Vance Honeycutt is Austin Overn. These are both two tremendous athletes, great runners, great defenders in the outfield. And Peter, you were all over this pre-draft, but Austin Overn was a player who really scuffled in his spring season with USC. And then he headed to the Cape. He performed pretty well. His pro debut in the draft report card for the Orioles, I said Austin Overn had the best pro debut for this org. He hit 280, 398, 467, three triples, five doubles. He sold 16 bags in 21 games. So it does seem like whatever adjustments he made in the Cape prior to the draft, they at least translated into his first taste of pro ball, which I feel like has to be encouraging for a player who has this sort of athleticism and this sort of impactful secondary tools that he does have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with Honeycutt, he was, as you said, he was one of the more polarizing players in the class. And we talked about him at length in the lead up to the draft. And I think that both you and I were a little bit lower on him than most. But with Baltimore, if I'm them, I'm happy with snagging him. And I guess not taking a flyer at 22 just because of the sheer upside and tools that he does have, but for that to fall into my lap at 22.
And even if I specifically am maybe a little bit lower on Vance Honeycutt, on draft day when the Orioles took him, I really did like that player and Oric pairing just for the reasons that you mentioned with their hitting development. Like, if I could choose an Oric for him to go to, Orioles would be on the short list, I would say.
100%. So I think that's a solid pick, and I think unsurprisingly so with him in his pro debut, there are still obviously some kinks to work out with the swing decisions and the hit tool itself. But again, still the upside is immense. But I was a big fan of the Austin Overn pick in the third round. I know before they got the UVA special with Ethan Anderson and Griff O'Farrell, two guys with advanced hit ability who I like. But Overton in the third round, I thought was a great pick. He was, in the lead up to the draft, probably the best player on the Cape. And that's saying something because this was when all the pre-draft guys, in addition to Overton, were there, and the pre-Team USA guys. I was really impressed with how he looked in the box. He cleaned up the operation a bunch. That was a lot less busy. It's kind of, he eliminated and trimmed a bunch of fat, and he can really go and get it in center field. And I think from a tool standpoint, he's not on par with Honeycutt with how loud everything is with Vance, just because, like, when it's all clicking for Vance, he's basically unmatched. But
there's
he's
just a little more physicality there with Vance, I think, a little more impact, a little more pop.
Yeah, and like Overton's more in the mold of this kind of, like, not wiry athlete like a Cam Cannarella, but it certainly is more like in that mold. But like, he's a exceptional athlete, 70 runner, used to be a wide receiver on the USC football team. There's some pop to the pull side. I'm really, I think, happy with the strides the hit tool and hit ability has taken. So again, he had a solid pro debut in his own right. So I was I'm happy that the early returns have been really positive with him.
Yeah. I'll say one player I want to mention before we move on to another team, and I'll give you a chance to maybe point out some players deeper in the draft that you like. One player who's going to be fascinating to watch is Griff O'Farrell, because at least in terms of our draft board, this would be one of the more polarizing players in the class. We did a piece shortly after the draft looking at the best and worst values, where we basically layer on slot values aligned with BA 500 grades and then compare them to what these players actually got in the draft. Griff O'Farrell, we started him out in the draft cycle around this range, kind of late first round in the 30s, I believe. Him and Anthony Silva were both in this range for the college shortstop class. And then both those players slid down the board throughout the spring for us. And I think Griff less so because of performance. His performance with Virginia was solid. But I just got a lot of scouts who questioned the sort of impact potential that he was going to bring to the table. And I also felt like there were a lot of scouts who were split between, would he stay at shortstop? Would he have to move to second base at the next level? More because of just arm strength than any questions about his actions or hands or glove work or reliability there. But if you just look at the money based on the BA board, Griff O'Farrell would have been one of the least valuable picks purely off the BA board. I'm not saying like this is a bad pick because of that. I just think the big deltas in expected draft bonus based on our rankings and what teams actually give them, I think, are just interesting players to talk through. Where are you at on Griff O'Farrell personally? Are you more towards the high side, which is where Baltimore took him? Or are you more with where we were at on the BA 500 rankings, which pulling it up right now, we had him, I think, kind of in the fourth round range. We had him 115 on our final board, right beside Jalen Flores.
Yeah, so people will probably roll their eyes and groan when I answered. I'd say somewhere in the middle. Like,
wow, you fence rider, Peter.
Exactly. No, but like, you got to really believe, I think, in the hit tool and the hit ability. And it's clear that Baltimore does, and for good reason. The track record is really impressive. It was, you know, he's got an outstanding feel for the barrel, consistently moves the baseball. There isn't a ton of impact there in the tank, but again, the hit tool, you know, I'd give it a six, and I think it's a pretty comfortable six coming out of the draft. So he's gonna have to really, really hit. It's such a small sample size. Like, it's a crumb of a crumb of a crumb at this point. It's only a 20 game sample for Griff. He handled himself well in high A, and then was just okay with the Delmarva Shorebirds in low A. But yeah, it's without a doubt a hit over power profile. I'm just curious to see how much he does hit, because I don't know how much, I guess, like, high level impact there's going to be in the box.
Yeah,
but I do have faith that he's really going to be able to swing it.
Yep. One player I'll mention further down the draft board, Nate George. I was always pretty excited about him in general. I think we had him ranked 272 on the BA 500. He's very athletic. He's a double plus runner. He's got a lot of physicality, not a lot of hit track record on the high school ranks for him, but he was a big signing for the team on day three. He signed for $455,000. So I think just in terms of like the financials, he's probably the guy on day three that a lot of people are looking at. I'm really just intrigued to see what he does in pro ball, like how advanced or how polished or how non-polished the hitting ability looks for him. And then I'll also just mention, as we go through here, through these teams, we'll talk about like how they use their money, but the Orioles did go to the full 5% overage. Their total signing bonuses handed out were $11.5 million basically for them. So nice to see them going to the full 5% overage. But any final comments on Baltimore, Peter?
I really like the class as a whole. Again, it's they're after my heart here with the college theme. And I think what I really like, and they've done it in past drafts too, and especially in recent drafts, is in these later rounds, particularly like 15 to 20, 14 to 20, somewhere mid to late day three, it's like, take a flyer on tools. Like Nate George has a ton of tools, and it's like, what are you going to lose if he doesn't pan out as a 16th rounder? Like, he's a guy with upside. He's flashed a bunch. If he doesn't pan out, you know, it's a 16th round pick. And if he does, you're going to look really, really good. I think sticking with the day three theme, Sebastian Gongora is a lot better of a pitcher than what he showed at Louisville, or at least what the back of the baseball card shows at Louisville. I really liked him coming out of Wright State in 2023. He's got a chance to be a really solid back of the rotation left-hander. And then I think I'll one-up you with my deeper sleeper and go with their 18th round pick, Michael Caldon from Felician College. He can really, really spin it. Fastball right now is just in the low 90s. I think it was only up to 94 this spring, but I think that there's some low-hanging fruit to clean up in the delivery to, you know, maximize the stuff. And, you know, I think once you get into the ability to develop pitching, it's like you can develop the stuff. You can add a couple of ticks to the fastball velocity, sharpen the stuff in general. It's a pretty impressive field of spin. Had a standout summer in the NECBL before eventually getting drafted. So again, 18th round pick. That's a guy that I'm a fan of.
Yeah. So that's the Orioles. We'll move on to our next team, the Red Sox, picking 12th overall in the first round. It seemed like throughout the spring, teams picking in this range, really just hoping one of the kind of consensus top 10 names would fall out of the top 10. That did happen with Boston. They scooped up Braden Montgomery out of Texas A&M with their first round pick. In the second round, they took Peyton Toll. Is it Toll, Tolley, Peter? Do you know for sure how he pronounces his last name?
I've been a Tolley guy. And okay. I haven't been corrected yet, so gotcha. I just kind of going to keep rolling with it until someone's like...
Peyton Toley, question mark, left-handed pitcher out of TCU in the second round. Brandon Neely, right-handed pitcher out of Florida in the third. Staying college-heavy, Oklahoma State outfielder Zach Earhart in the fourth. And then Brandon Clark, left-handed pitcher out of State College of Florida in the fifth round. So in the draft theme, I put on swing and miss fastballs for the Red Sox, because each of these three first pitchers I mentioned do have fastballs with mischaracteristics, whether that's more in terms of velocity like Neely or with Toley, just with tremendous life and a low kind of deceptive arm slot and release height. But what are your overall thoughts on Boston's draft class, Peter?
I thought it was okay. I think with you hit on it, at least started to hit on it with Braden Montgomery, like another thing that we talked about at length in the lead up to the draft, especially when I think the picture became more clear with how the class was going to look, like someone really good was going to probably fall outside of the top 10 and into someone's lap. It just so happened that it was Montgomery, and I'm a big fan of him. And I know that's a very cold take, but I think even more so than his 12th overall selection indicates, like, the hit tool has just improved year over year between Stanford and A&M, which was the key with him. He cleaned up the swing and miss. It's plus power. It's a really explosive operation in both sides of the box. And it's weird to say impact defender in right field, but I think when you're looking at impact defenders in a corner outfield spot, like, that's as close as you're going to get to it. I mean, it's a 70 arm, moves well out there. He's a good athlete. So I mean, I was a really big fan of scooping him at 12. Tolley's another really interesting guy. Gets crazy extension on his heater. I think it's over 7 feet. Mixes in a really effective slider and a changeup. And then Earhart, I was a fan of at Oklahoma State after his true freshman year, took a step back as a sophomore and then found it again as a junior. Just like a really high energy fireball, like compact athlete type of guy. Mm-hmm. It was some growing pains in his pro debut, but that was to be expected. They threw him kind of right into the fire in high A. So I'm curious to see how he progresses. But with the arms, I think like, I don't know. What are your thoughts on some of these arms? Because like Brandon Neely in the third round, I think that he's definitely a reliever for me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he could be a damn good reliever. So, I mean, getting that in the third round isn't necessarily.
Yeah. There are some
outlandish, but
there's some teams where you look at the pitchers they took and it definitely feels like they more targeted like these starter profiles who maybe are a little bit light in the stuff department, but you feel good about their strikes. And clearly the team believes they can maybe develop a little bit more pure stuff or velocity. With the Red Sox, it really seemed like stuff and miss traits, were prioritized. I think all these pitchers here, Tolley, Neely, Clark, do have some reliever risk. They all have big fastballs. I think I'm fine with kind of where they took them. I think part of it might be just that, like, we had heard the Red Sox link to Peyton Tolley pretty consistently getting towards the draft. So when they took him, it wasn't really a huge surprise in the second round. I don't know that any of them are like specifically like my type, the guys that I tend to really like. But I think they all make sense with where they were taken. I know this is not a college player, but I'm intrigued with how they use Conrad Kaysen. I believe he was selected officially as a two-way player. He was a legitimate two-way player coming out of high school, really athletic, has a big fastball. He's been up to 98 before. I think he's kind of raw in a lot of areas of the game, but I like the fact that they were able to sign an athlete, like super young two-way player in the eighth round, I thought was pretty impressive. I mean, he did sign for over $1 million. I think he was their third largest signee just in terms of signing bonus. So maybe don't view him as like a typical eighth rounder. But that one is intriguing to me. I think in general, like, it's hard to overlook Brandon Montgomery at 12. Didn't think he should have been available there. He was. The Red Sox grabbed him. I think that was the right move for them, given how the board played out. So I like that. I mean, I like getting a player like Brady Tigert in the 12th round. I think he's another arm that's got just a lot of pure arm talent. And if the Red Sox can just coax a little bit more consistency control out of him, I mean, he has some of the best pure field to spin in the class. I think his curveball and slider, just in a vacuum, are tremendous pitches. And if he can just become even a fringy strike thrower and have those pitches play up a little bit more in terms of like usability, they're both tremendous, like 2,900 RPM breaking ball with the curve. He's touched 97. There's like a lot of stuff here. It's just the Red Sox have been such a hitter heavy farm system recently. I don't know if I have like a strong feel either way as to like if they're going to get the most of them in player development, but clearly there's a lot of impact to be found.
Yeah, there's upside. And I think if this was another team's draft, like even if this was Baltimore's draft class, like I'd maybe be more excited just given their track record of developing recently. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like you said, there's stuff, there's upside. There are guys that are, you know, you want to like and fun profiles. It's just the development aspect is what's going to get it over the goal line. So I'm excited to see how it pans out. I think I didn't even know if you wanted to take it in this direction, but like day two guys that I'm a fan of in particular are Brandon Clark from State College of Florida, typical kind of JUCO powerhouse, and then also Will Turner from South Alabama.
Yep.
And starting with Clark, it's this typical like mold of stuff plus upside plus like projectable left-handed. Like, there's a lot to like with him, I think, from an intangible standpoint, and he's a really fun, I think, ball of clay for a player development department to get their hands on. It's just like, what are they going to do with it? Like, the strikes need to develop. There's some consistency that needs to kind of be ironed out, I think, with him, but the upside is pretty immense. And then I think with Turner, He was someone in 2023, or like after his 2023 season, he really popped. Even heading into the 2023 season, like an under the hood guy, like from a data perspective, he always stood out for his contact ability, up the middle type of profile. And last year he took a step back, which was he took a major step back. He hit sub 220, only hit 9 home runs, like in the college game today. Like if you're not hitting like 15 plus jacks, unless you're like an extreme like contact oriented guy, like come on, it's like you're hitting golf balls and every single bat is so juice. But nonetheless, like he was coming into the 2024 season, I think, is a lot of people's like sleeper ish to go on day one. Obviously it didn't pan out, but one thing with Turner, when you want to talk about low hanging fruit, I think is in 23, he had this low kind of relaxed handset, like super loose swing with a ton of buggy whip. As I kind of call it, last year he raised his hands. There was still some of that looseness, but it's clear it was just an adjustment that wasn't productive. So I think I saw, I wish I could give the person proper credit because I did see it on Twitter, like a couple of weeks ago, but the Red Sox unsurprisingly lowered Turner's hands again, in an effort to, I think, unlock what he had going in 23, but it was a rough pro debut for him. He was just 6-74, in 23 games, but again, they threw him right into high A. There's going to be some developing growing pains with him, but, I like his athleticism and instincts in center field. There's an above average arm. I think that he'll get maybe some chance to stick there, but I think eventually he'll probably move off of it into a corner. But
yeah,
again, he's someone that I like as well.
One of the later picks that I'll mention here is just the guy we named for best day three pick in their org. That's right-hander Stephen Brooks. He was drafted in the 11th round, signed for $200,000. I did mention how a lot of these Red Sox pitchers are kind of stuffed monsters that you maybe want to see a little bit more pitchability. I think Brooks is maybe the opposite of that. He'd shown solid control and command in a pair of seasons, really 3 seasons actually, at Cal Poly, career minor league walk rate of 2.7 per 9. He doesn't throw the biggest fastball. He averaged around 90 miles per hour last spring, has been up to 93, but he does throw from a lower release height. He gets a lot of riding life on that pitch. So maybe it plays up, maybe they add a little bit more velocity to it moving forward. But I know he's an arm that the Red Sox are specifically pretty excited about, and maybe a guy who was a little bit under the radar in terms of the draft. But a lot of teams have shown an ability to find these later college pitchers. Maybe he's a guy to keep an eye on for that. In terms of how they spent their money, the Red Sox also went to the full 5% overage. We love to see that. Just over $11 million spent in their draft. So yeah, that's the Red Sox.
Yeah, I think one more guy that is someone to watch slash circle on day three is Alex Bouchard from Lehigh. Only threw 6 2/3 innings, I believe, this year. Struck out 11. Just another one of those like really interesting, like under the hood type guys, plus stuff, moves well on the mound. Like there's upside. That's a fun flyer to take on day three. And then what's this D'Angelo Ortiz's? No, I'm kidding. yeah. Alex Bouchard's another fun one. So, yeah, like there's again, like stuff plus upside is the theme here. Braden Montgomery serves as a really good anchor, I think, to the class as a whole. Peyton Tolley, you could say the same on the pitching side. I think that's one of the more like higher floor picks, not necessarily a stupid high ceiling, but again, I think that's a pretty safe pick. And where they got him, I'm a fan. I don't think that there's really any reliever risk. He really competes on the mound. It's a fun combination of strikes and stuff, and you have these really appealing, I think, underlying traits from the left side. So.
Yeah, maybe I could have been underselling his command earlier in the conversation. So good call on that one. Okay, let's move on to the Yankees. They had a very compelling draft from the jump. They decided to go super pitching heavy, super college pitching heavy. Each of their first seven picks were college arms. They took Ben Hess in the first round at 26 overall. They took Bryce Cunningham in the second round out of Vanderbilt, right-handed pitcher. Thatcher Hurd out of LSU, right-handed pitcher. Gage Zeal out of Miami, right-hander. Grayson Carter out of Vanderbilt. On and on, they continue to take more arms. I believe this is the first draft for the Yankees since 2017 and Clark Schmidt, when they drafted a college pitcher in the first round and maybe just a pitcher overall with their first pick. So that was kind of telling. I think we wrote about them very quickly after the first or second day of the draft as like being an interesting draft, because like all of their arms were these physical pitchers with above average extension. A lot of these pitchers that I just named early on in the draft fit those categories. They throw hard, they're physical, they get down the mound. In some cases, I think there is questions of like stuff over performance. Like Ben Hess was a guy who consistently scouts really wanted to like, and I don't think he was like consensus in the first round range. We had him more in like the second round on our final board, just because of some inconsistencies with his performance with Alabama. But everyone loved the body, everyone loved the fastball slider combination. Thatcher Hurd, kind of a similar deal. When he's right, he absolutely looks the part. Great body, above average fastball, probably a plus breaking ball. And he just seemed to kind of not be able to consistently post, get hit around at times. I think in general, there's been a little bit of a market inefficiency, or not a market inefficiency, but a lot of teams have done well by just drafting Miami pitchers and then watching them immediately get better in pro ball. Alejandro Rosario, Herrick Hernandez is another player from this class. The Yankees will be looking for Gage Zeal maybe to do the same thing. We don't have a ton of like new insight into these pitchers for the Yankees because none of them were activated in official games after signing. It's just hitters for the Yankees. But Peter, I don't know if you love pitching heavy drafts, but you love college heavy drafts, and this one certainly qualifies for that.
Yeah, I do like this class, and there's a clear theme on college pitching, obviously. I think that, again, this is not a super crazy thing to say. Like, I think that the centerpiece of the class when all is said and done is actually going to be Thatcher Hurd. And I know that from a fame standpoint, like, he's the guy. But when I saw him this summer, I was really curious to see how he'd look on the Cape and see if he could kind of find it a little bit like he did late in 2023 with LSU, how he really had his entire freshman year at UCLA. 2024 he was down, but he was really, really impressive. Like, everything that kid does, at least from what I saw, was big league. Like, from how he carried himself before the game, how he carried himself in bullpens, like locked in every single pitch, like blinders down mentality. And I think that that's just the cherry on top of who he is, like, from a pitching standpoint and from a stuff standpoint. Like, fastball when I saw him was up to 98 with life through the zone. I think that maybe the best pitch in his arsenal is actually his cutter. Like, he has a really advanced feel for it, throws it to both lefties and righties, gets under the hands of lefties, kind of darts away. I don't want to say darts because it's not like a finesse type of pitch, but I left the yard one day with a 6 on his cutter and a 6 on his curveball and then a 6 on his fat. Like, when it's on, like, he looks the part of a really, really good and effective starting pitcher. And like I said, everything he does is big league. Like, he walks into the park and it's just a little bit of a different feel than when everyone else does. And it's not just kind of like from a cockiness standpoint, it's just how he carries himself, and it was really impressive to see. Like, he is super dialed.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed at Baseball America is that it makes hiring easy. Everything's in one place. I get my applications. I get notifications when I get new applications. I get to contact prospective candidates all on Indeed. I can move people to the next level all on Indeed, and we can keep all of everyone on staff involved in the hiring process up to date, all at Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Griffin Herring in the sixth, I really like. Two-pitch guy right now. Slider is kind of, he's kind of really relied heavily on his slider. I'd like to see the fastball shape refined a little bit. To get some more whiff with it. I think it was sub 20% this year at LSU, but and he doesn't have a third pitch right now. I think that they're probably going to work on developing the changeup, but clean delivery, strike thrower. You can kind of use him, I think, in a multitude of ways. Curious how they choose to use him. I'm sure they're going to give him a chance to start. And then, like you said, with Hess, it was like, it's stuff over performance, but the stuff is really impressive. It's just like, kind of how you said with like an Alejandro Rosario, it's like, you know, clean up the usage of it, maximize the shape by, you know, I guess refining the location a little bit. Like, why were you getting hit at Alabama? Like, what can we do to clean this up? So I think that, you know, you're going to attack that. And then Bryce Cunningham as well. He was a guy that I became enamored with. Dating way back to the summer of 2023, and that kind of carried over into this spring. And I know that he's Ben's guy.
Yeah, I think he took him in every single staff draft that we had. In
the first round too.
Every time, yeah, it would be like 20 to 30 range. If Ben's on the clock, he's taking Cunningham. So I think I anticipated Cunningham to go before Ben Hess. We had them like back to back on the draft board, and they got similar bonus money from the Yankees, but the order was kind of, I wouldn't say it's surprising to me, but if I had to bet prior to the draft, I would have expected Cunningham to go first. But they got both, so who cares?
Yeah, I was gonna say they got Cunningham in the second. Like, I think that's a great spot for him. Yeah,
agreed.
Really, really like legit fastball, slider, 1-2 punch, like starter traits. You talk about the intangibles. He's a classic Vandy kid, exceptional makeup, and then you go and you get Thatcher Hurd in the third round. Like, I'd argue that their second and third round picks, even from an individual standpoint, and I could be a prisoner of the moment here with Thatcher, but like, I'm just as excited, if not more excited, about those two than Ben Hess. And that's not a knock at all on Ben Hess. Like, he's a really good pitcher, I think, in his own right. You can get excited about him, but I think that's more of a testament to the ability that both Cunningham and Hurd have, because Hurd coming into the year was like, okay, if he can carry over what he did in the national title game, which, if people don't remember, I think Wyatt Lankford, I think he walked the first hitter, and then Wyatt Lankford took him to the absolute moon and Florida went up 2-0. But then he went on to throw 5 straight no-hit innings. LSU runs away and wins the national title. Like, if he was able to recapture that and put it together for a full season, like, he was being talked about as a potential first-round arm. So,
yeah.
I like it. And then they went and I'll let you carry the rest, but there are some fun little players on day three they got too.
Yeah, I mean, if you like stuff, you like pitching, there's a lot to be found in this draft class. There are a number of players. It's really hard to decide on like who had the best fastball in this class, because we haven't even talked too much about Grayson Carter, but his velocity and like the cutting action he gets on that pitch is pretty tremendous. Like, I think that could be a double plus offering. But to touch on a few hitters here, I was kind of intrigued, I should say, by Austin Green, who they got in the 14th round. I talked to some scouts who really thought he was like a high level competitor in the box, even if he wasn't the toolsiest player. But maybe the most interesting player post-draft, after getting a little taste of the debut, is Brennan Jones, who's an outfielder out of Kansas State. He was selected in the 12th round. The Yankees signed him for $150,000, so they didn't even have to tap into the pool to get him signed. But his pro debut was tremendous. He played at low A Tampa and high A Hudson Valley, 24 games combined between the two levels. He slashed 267, 471, 453. Walked 29 times, struck out 21 times, five doubles, and he went 18 for 18 in stolen bases. He is a speedy guy. He stole 40 bags with Kansas State last spring. He played all three outfield positions. I think he showed solid exit velocity data in pro ball as well, but just the combination of performance, speed, defensive versatility, and zone skills, I think for a guy who signed in the 12th round, it's certainly an encouraging start and definitely a player who I didn't know as much about at the time as I do now, and I'm pretty intrigued with him.
Yeah, you stole one of mine.
I was gonna mention him. He was so exciting. But please elaborate if you want. Feel free.
No, you hit on it perfectly. Like, I think that in the 12th round, he's a really fun player, and he flashed the tools in his pro debut. Like you mentioned, like, he can really run, and he knows how to run, which helps maximize that tool even more. He was 18 for 18 on stolen base attempts. There's some thump in there. Feel for the zone. The swing decisions are really polished, and like you said, there is some hitability and impressive contact skills. I think across Hudson Valley and Tampa, it was like an 89% overall in zone contact rate and an 80 or 81% overall contact rate. And it's just like, he kind of showed glimpses of each tool he possesses. So that's someone I'm excited to watch. And then also Marshall Tool, little bit of a, in a similar breath to Jones, like, can really run. Impressive 2024 season at Wofford. He had 375, 15 doubles. Ethan Conrad led the country in triples. I think he had like 13, but Tool had 10 triples, 9 home runs, 43 bags. And like with Wofford, they're an absolute base running factory. So like some of the guys' run tools will be exacerbated a little bit just because of the system. But Tool is a legit runner. Stole 8 bags in his pro debut. Again, flashed a little bit of the sneaky thump he's got, put a ball over the fence, and then it's without a doubt like hit over power at the plate. But again, sound approach from him. I think they got him in the 15th round. I think he was someone that I think I started to like him later than I should have, but in the 15th round, that's someone that I'm more than happy with snagging. So
yeah,
really like him.
Yankees also the third team we've talked about today who went to the full 5% overage in their pool, so kudos to them for that. Just over $8.5 million in this draft class for them in terms of their signings. But let's get into Tampa Bay. The Rays were picking number 18th. That's not grammatically correct. They're picking 18th overall. They selected Theo Gillen, high school outfielder, shortstop, infielder out of Texas. The first round, they took Emilian Petre, second baseman out of Kentucky. In the second round, they had a compensation pick. After that, they took Tyler Bell, who did not sign, was one of a handful of players this year who did not sign in the top 10 rounds. Nathan Flewelling, super young Canadian catcher with big power. In the third round, in the fourth round, they took Nate Knowles, a right-handed pitcher out of William & Mary. And then in the fifth round, they took Jacob Kamats, another pitcher, this time out of Oregon State University. So I guess this is our first team that they didn't sign everyone at the very top, and not signing Tyler Bell, I think complicates things here, because you obviously want to get that player signed, and it was a bit of a bummer to not see that happen for them. I really like Tyler Bell's athleticism, but I also really like Theo Gillen, his profile in general. I thought he was one of the more exciting offensive profiles in the high school class. Again, not a great high school class overall, but Theo Gillen has a great track record of hitting. He's got bat speed. He can hit for average. He can hit for power. I like the fact that they took him as an outfielder. Hopefully they'll just put him out there, let him play, and see what happens. But what do you think about this Rays draft class, Peter?
I like it. And again, one of the underlying themes, maybe even not so underlying themes of what we've been talking about today, is like also the player development department of each respective organization. And I'm a fan of what the Rays have going, especially on the pitching side. And I think that there are a lot of arms that you can be excited about, both just from like straight up in the draft for who they are, but then even more so just given how the Rays develop stuff and how they develop arms in general. I think like Jansen Kiesel immediately sticks out. Where'd they get him? I think they got him in the sixth round. Yeah, it was the sixth round.
Yeah, like sixth round, signing for 272.
Low launch heater out of a really like, it just explodes out of this low three quarter slot. I think it was up to 98 or 99 at Oklahoma State, was allegedly up to 100 in the fall. In his draft year, pairs it with a slider that I think can be really good. And then the key for him is the development of a third pitch. When I saw him in the summer pre-draft, he turned over a couple of really good changeups. I think the key for him is just gaining consistency with it and getting a better feel, but that looks the part of a potentially average third pitch. And I think that the slider already is a 55 type deal, 55 pitch. And then the heater is obviously the headliner with him. And then another key for Kiesel is just the continued development in the strike throwing department. Like that has been one bugaboo for him throughout his college career. So if they can get some, if they can just refine the command a little bit, you know, they could be, I think he's got a chance to be a monster. But potentially the arm that I'm most excited about is Nate Knowles from William & Mary. They got him in the fourth round. He was someone I think throughout the spring that was, you know, we were talking about him as just like this consistent riser on draft boards, and we had him I think juiced pretty good in the final BA 500, but
I have it here, we ranked him 152. I think he was a guy who kind of continued moving up, and you'll probably get in here and talk about it, but I was super intrigued with just his usage as a college pitcher. It was a very unusual pattern of usage for a starting pitcher in college, and I don't know, like, if there have been a lot of pitchers who have really struggled to make the college to pro adjustment, but it certainly is an adjustment. And with Nate Knowles, just based on how he was used, I don't think that'll be too much of an issue for him.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, it's a very intriguing combination of strikes and stuff. Like a tick above average, I think, strike throwing ability. Fastball is up to 95. Ton of ride through the zone. Negative 4.5. Like 3.5 VAA, but I don't, maybe the headliner of his arsenal, I want to say, is his cutter, like his high 80s to low 90s cutter. You can almost, I think, like deem it a slutter if you want. Like it just bears in on the knuckles of left-handed hitters, away from right-handed hitters. He's got an advanced feel for the pitch. The pitch's shape, I think, helps maximize the effectiveness of it, and so does his general command and strike throwing ability. Like, I think that that's, again, it's a blend of strikes and stuff. The Rays know how to develop arms. I would have been excited for whichever team ended up with him, but the fact that it was the Rays has me even a little bit more excited for what he can be. So
yeah, in general, I think the Rays like these sort of fastballs. You mentioned it with Kiesel, you mentioned it with Knowles, but even beyond them, players like Jacob Kamats, players like Garrett Gainey, like a lot of the descriptors and how we describe these fastballs in their draft reports, like the above average carry or really good riding life of these pitches or release characteristics that help it play up, I think clearly that was a trait that the Rays targeted in this draft specifically, with a lot of the pitchers they had in the top 10 rounds. Some of the guys who were drafted shortly after that. I also just like the fact that, again, not signing Tyler Bell really changes this a lot. I think in terms of like maximizing your pool of money to spend, the Rays were, I believe, the least efficient in terms of every team. They just spent 97% of their total pool, which would have been the lowest figure. So that's not great. You obviously can't plan for that. You can plan for that. I just, not to say I think like it's the Rays' fault that signing didn't happen. It is a bit unfortunate, but I kind of like the pairing of these intriguing traits on the pitchers, some guys who know how to pitch, and then just getting some tools, some athleticism with players like Gillen and Bell had he signed, and Nathan Flewelling, who did sign. And really, Nathan Flewelling was one of the most impressive players that I saw at the combine. The fact that he was 17 years old and hitting with wood and showing exit velocities that were among the best of the entire event with college players who were 5 years older than him at the time, I thought was just super impressive. So I like that one. I'm curious what you think about the Emilian Petre pick in the second round. That would have been another player similar to how we talked about Griff O'Farrell, where it's maybe a little bit further off the board than where we had him ranked. We had Emilian Petre 261. The Rays take him in the second round and sign him for $1.5 million. So were we light on him? Are the Rays too aggressive on him? What are your thoughts on that pick?
My guess is that Tampa had a hunch slash almost knew that he wasn't going to be there for their next pick. So it was like, you know, it's clear that they liked him enough where they'd take him in the second. It's personally higher than where I slash we have him, but it wasn't like I was sitting there on the night of the draft being like, whoa, when they took Petre 58th yeah. overall. Like, yeah, it was a surprise, but it wasn't like some outlandishly high pick. I think it's plus hit, handles himself fine at second base. There's a little bit of thump in there. I'm just kind of curious to see what the power is with Wood and what it can be. I think at best it might be like a 45, but like,
yeah, he had his slug was like just 1 point higher than his OBP in his pro debut. It was a good pro debut, 21 games at low A Charleston. He hit 299, 402, 403, walked 12 times, struck out 11 times, six doubles, one triple, no homers. But yeah, I imagine the Rays think he's going to be like an impact type defender at second base and are really high on the pure hit tool. But I do have some questions about just the amount of power you're going to get with him. A few notes on Tampa Bay in general. I believe they were the most Canadian heavy team this year. They selected three Canadian board players in the draft between Petre, Nathan Flewelling, and then shortstop Jack Lyons, who they took in the 12th round, all Canadian born players. So shout out Team C on that front. And also a strong debut from outfielder Connor Hudsak in the 13th round. He showed really impressive exit velocities in his pro debut, got up to 110.2 max, hit four home runs in 21 games with low A Charleston as well. So any final thoughts on Tampa Bay?
Yeah, the trio of arms they took late day two. That's a trio to follow. Ryan Andrade from Pitt, Jaden Volker from Northern Essex Community College up in my neck of the woods. Shout out the JUCO Bandits in Mass. And then Garrett Gainey from South Carolina. I think with Gainey, like, it's reliever all the way, but you could have a really effective and standout reliever type. It strikes. He's got a really effective 1-2 punch. Volker stuff is the name of the game here. It's just how you're going to develop it. And then with Andrade, I think the Alejandro Rosario comp is like really dangerous to throw around because not everyone
that's gonna be our favorite one. We're gonna dream on everyone improving, like Rosario.
I know it, like not every like far from everyone is gonna be Alejandro Rosario. A lot of guys unfortunately are just gonna kind of be what they were, for lack of better phrasing, in college. But like, I think that the first thing you can look for when, like, you know, like, why did someone not throw the ball well and caught, like with Andrade, he had a 7.3 ERA at Pitt, gave up 72 hits in 63 innings. So it's like, why? Well, with him, like, it's pretty impressive from a stuff standpoint. I think another key with him is improving a little bit on the strike throwing ability. Like, it was, I think, only at a 60% overall clip. Threw his fastball 51% of the time. I think it was up to 95, 96 last year.
Yes, with great riding life.
Yep. Yeah, that's been the name of the game with Andrade since he was at Rhode Island.
When he was at the combine, I thought he had one of the better bullpen sessions. And I saw the stuff, and I thought the fastball life and just that BP session was pretty impressive. It's actually a decent comp to Michael Massey's fastball, which is regarded as one of the better fastballs in the class. He showed solid secondaries. And yeah, if you saw him that day and then you look up at the results with Pittsburgh. It is surprising. But he's been a pretty below average strike thrower overall in his college career. So I guess that's like the kind of key area. But I love the arm. I love the arm talent.
Yeah, like you said, there's real stuff. It's like, how much can they squeeze out of the strike throwing, riding fastball, best in the top of the zone, with some impressive field of spin. I'd start throwing his secondaries more, and just sequencing wise, like, you know, if you can, I'd look at it from a sequencing standpoint, and then also if you can up the usage with anything at all. But like you said, it's a fun arm. There's arm strength, there's stuff. The Rays have a track record with developing arms. It's that trio 7, 8, and 9. I'd watch them closely.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move into our final team for today's episode. That is Toronto. The Blue Jays were picking 20th overall in the first round this year. They somehow managed to get Trey Savage all the way down to that pick at 20 overall in the second round. They took right-handed pitcher Cal Steven out of Mississippi State. In the third round, they took left-handed pitcher Johnny King, high school arm. In the fourth round, they took Bucknell third baseman Sean Keyes. And with their comp pick at 136, just after the fourth round, they took Indiana outfielder Nick Mitchell. And then to round out their top five round picks, they took Jackson Wentworth, right-handed pitcher out of Kansas State, 158 overall. I was shocked with how far Trey Savage kept sliding on draft day. I shouldn't say shocked. There were some like buzzing that maybe he'd slip a little bit, but given the tiering of the college pitchers in this class, given what Trey Savage had done at ECU, given his pure stuff, the fact that he returned after his collapsed lung and pitched well and looked kind of the same as we'd seen him all spring, I really expected him to go top 15. I thought 15 was about the floor for him in the draft. And he goes five picks later than that to the benefit of the Blue Jays, who I think found the third best arm while picking at 20 overall. So, I mean, this pick is going to do a lot for their class. Obviously, it was $4 million signing as their first rounder. Were you as excited about them getting Trey Savage as I was, Peter, or are there reasons to be concerns and maybe reasons why he slid that maybe I'm just discounting?
No, I'm right there with you. And I think that I have to imagine they were just as, if not even more excited to get him. Like, you want to talk about strikes and stuff, like, this is your guy. It's a really physical, durable frame at 6'4", 225, fastballs up into the upper 90s, averaged, or I think up to like 22 inches of ride. And I'd stick a 55 on it. The gyro slider is a plus pitch, gets a ton of swing and miss. The split change, I think, might be the best pitch in his arsenal. Like, that's a comfy six for me. And then his curveballs also flash, and that's as a fourth pitch, like, that's more than fine. And his ability to locate and command his arsenal helps everything play up. So, like, the delivery at times, aesthetically at least, can look a little, I don't want to say clunky, but it's not like this buttery smooth, like,
yeah. There were athletic. Some scouts who kind of nitpicked it a little bit, critiqued it, and wondered about it.
Yeah, so I again, that's like the one little thing, but I'm a real fan. Like, there's no reliever risk for me personally. So I was a massive fan of the pick.
Yeah, no, I like it quite a bit. And moving down to some picks after that, Cal Steven has above average fastball. Above average control, another pitch that's like in the low 90s, fastball up to 96, above average ride and carry. Johnny King is kind of like a different flavor, but still, like, the fact that we went pitcher, I think is interesting here for Toronto. He's more of this like young, projectable, athletic pitcher that you can dream on. Maybe doesn't have the same sort of now stuff as a lot of these guys do, but it's a 6'4". 210 pound frame that I think is going to add a lot of good strength moving forward. He can spin the ball. He's thrown two breaking balls that have above average potential, at least. We put a 60 on the curveball out of the draft. So he's an intriguing kind of upside pick. And then a lot of the players that the Blue Jays drafted this year went out and hit really well. Fourth rounder Sean Keyes had an OPS of 829. In A-ball, Eddie Micheletti Jr., 880 OPS in A-ball, eighth rounder Aaron Parker, Same deal, A-Ball, 899 OPS. All these guys went out and performed pretty well. Are there any bats that you're particularly excited about in this class?
Yeah, honestly, the two fourth round picks, Keys and Mitchell. Keys especially, I know that he was someone that sort of popped, I guess, after what he did in the 2023 summer on the Cape. It was a really limited sample size, but it was super loud. And then he went back to Bucknell and lit it up. For me, that's a comfortable 55 you can stick on both the hit and power tool. Power is more like a 6 to the pull side. Really easy swing, gets the ball up in the air, generates consistent impact, has a knack for backspinning the baseball. Defensively, he's fine at third. The arm plays, the actions, what, like, they need refining for sure. It can look a little clunky and awkward at times, but what's been encouraging for me is how they've progressed. Like, he's gotten a lot better over there since 23, and I know that he's going to really work at it with Baltimore. So I think, like, he will more than hold his own over there at third, and it helps that the arm plays. It's a very, I think, appealing hit power blend, and he already flashed it in his pro debut with Dunedin. And then Nick Mitchell in a similar breath. I perhaps, like, even a maybe more impressive pro debut than Keys, but, like, another guy that coming into the draft and really throughout his career was hit over power, and for good reason. Like, it was plus contact skills, polished approach, advanced feel for the barrel, would run into one every now and again. But in his pro debut with Dunedin in 22 games, he hit 4 home runs. He hit 5 at Indiana in all of 2024 in his career, which was his career high throughout college. So, I mean, if there's even just a little bit of thump in there, like, that's a great cherry on top to what I think is already a really intriguing profile, because I'm a believer in the hit tool. Like, I think he's going to really, really hit. That's all he did. Like, did it at Indiana, did it at Western Illinois, did it in the Northwoods, did it on the Cape. If you just look at his, I think, BREF Cape stats, you'll see like a sub 260 average, but he really hit in the playoffs. And then he also hit 290 with a different team that wasn't Hyannis. But yeah, those two fourth round bats, really, really like that duo. And then Aaron Parker from Santa Barbara, like, very quietly, I think, put together one of the more impressive seasons, at least on the West Coast. This year hit a tick under 380 with 12 doubles, 12 jacks, productive pro debut with Dunedin, 8 doubles and 5 home runs in 24 games. So I think that there is, at least with these middle round bats, and I think just in general, like, there's an appealing, like, well-roundedness to a degree, some more than others, like, especially with, like, a Keys to the profile. Like, there's hittability, there's a little bit of juice, and I think that it bodes well. And I guess if I were to pick a really deep sleeper in this class, it's Colby Martin from Southeastern. It's just, like, huge arm strength. I think he was up to 102, but it's 20 command. So if he can at all be around the strike zone, there's a chance he's
He walked 14 batters in his 8.2 innings in pro ball in his debut. So
yeah, and a 20 might somehow be generous on the command, but if he can find it, like, that's
a few other names to know later in the draft. I mean, maybe the obvious one here is Carson Messina. He was drafted in the 12th round, signed for $550,000. We had him as a top 200 prospect in the class fairly easily. Younger brother of South Carolina catcher Cole Messina, who was also drafted in the 3rd round this year. But he's got just tremendous ability to spin the baseball. His mid-80 slider has earned lots of 70 grades. The fastball and slider are just pretty loud in general. I think, like the pitcher you were just mentioning, Colby Martin, he needs to improve the command. I don't think it's quite as scary at this point, but there are some, like, starter reliever questions given the strike throwing with him that he'll need to iron out moving forward. And also, the Blue Jays seem to really like Jonathan Todd, who they signed for just a few thousand bucks in the 15th round. He signed for $5,000. Posted a 4.0 ERA over 36 innings out of the pen with Western Carolina. He throws a 92-95 mile per hour fastball. It's got good life on that pitch and has just a really impressive frame at 6'6", 225 pounds. It sounds like Toronto is pretty excited about his fastball slider combo, and maybe he wouldn't be the most obvious guy to point out on day three, just given the signing bonuses. So maybe keep an eye on him as well.
Yeah, that's a good shout with him. He was another guy that I was a fan of, and
yeah,
off to a good start. So
cool. Well, that is the AL East. So those are draft reviews. If you want more info on all these classes, you can look at the full draft report cards for the AL East and all the teams in the league. So any final comments before we get out of here, Peter? I know it's been a little more than we have been going over an hour, but
I like it though. So. I kind of like the length, and not to show our hand, but this will be for the next handful of weeks, division by division. So I'm really excited to touch on all 30. I guess a question, not a comment. Who's your favorite class in the division?
Oh, okay. Let me kind of piece through them here. You go first. I don't know why I didn't think about this. It's a completely obvious thing to do. But I don't know off the top of my head. You give yours and I'll try and figure out who I like the best.
For me, I didn't really need to think about it all that much. Like I really like Baltimore's class, and I think it's from a talent standpoint that they like just
I'm supposed to choose Baltimore because I'm the UNC guy and they took Honeycutt, but here you are.
Hey, we can both go Baltimore.
I won't go Baltimore.
I really like the college theme to it. There's a mix of, I think, just guys with really high ceilings, and then also I think rather manageable floors. The bats definitely carry the class with Honeycutt, O'Farrell, Ethan Anderson over, and even like Ryan Stafford, who we didn't touch on, but that was another guy that I really liked at Cal Poly. Was a big fan of them snagging him in the fifth round, but nonetheless, like, there were some impressive and interesting college arms that they got as well, especially for where they got them. Mm-hmm. Like they had a really, I think, productive late day two and day three, as a whole. And I think that the point that I alluded to when talking about the class in general is, like, I'm a huge fan of how they develop their guys and their player development department in general. So I'm just really confident that they're going to get the most out of this class, which for me puts it over the goal line.
Yeah. Okay. I think as I've been looking over them and kind of trying to piece together which teams excite me the most, the one I keep coming back to and just feeling most strongly about is the Yankees. I just like a lot of the arms they have here. They've got a lot of firepower. They've got a lot of pure stuff. The debut of Brendan Jones, who is a guy that, like, coming into this, I would not have been able to tell you a whole lot or have a lot of confidence in how much I liked him. I like a lot of their other hitters on day three. I think each of Hess, Cunningham, Hurd, Grayson Carter, Herring could all be like solid big leaguers in various roles. I just think the firepower of all the arms they took here is really exciting to me. I think, like, I really liked Yesavage, getting him at 20 for Toronto. I really liked the Theo Gillen pick. I like the Red Sox getting Brandon Montgomery to slip to 12. Like, those are all maybe the most exciting first overall picks in this division. But yeah, I think this is a really exciting collection of upside pitching for the Yankees. So I'll go with them.
Yeah. I was down to Baltimore, New York, went Baltimore, but
cool.
Like you also said, reasons to be excited about all five of these classes, if you're a fan of any of the five teams.
For sure. Cool. Well, Peter, anything you want to plug before we get out of here?
Yeah. So this week was more of a quiet week outside of the podcast. Shout out to the Prospect Handbook. If you're looking for a gift to get yourself or any big baseball fan in your life, I promise that neither you nor them would complain with getting the Prospect Handbook. It's super detailed scouting reports on 30, I think it's going to actually end up being 40 players in all 30 organizations, just given like the next 10. But again, super detailed, in-depth reports on so many guys. It's just such a treasure trove of knowledge. But for me, next week on Thursday, next week's a busy week, just in general, but on Thursday, top 10 incoming freshmen. There's a, as always, it's a fun freshman class. William Schmidt from LSU will be the headliner. And then back with the draft pod on Friday with the AL Central. So
cool.
That's it for me. And then further down the pike, Padres top 10 reveal plus the Padres chat. So if you are so inclined, when the day comes, drop a few questions both to me and then also to anyone on their respective days of the chat, because the top 10s are really good, but you know, you can, I think the answers to the impromptu chat questions are really fun as well.
Yeah. So those should be coming on the site in the very near future, just top 10s in general rolling out for next year. So keep an eye on that. Otherwise, yeah, what Peter is plugging is the stuff to pay attention to. Thank you guys for hanging out with us, talking some draft, listening to some draft. For Peter, I'm Carlos. We'll see you guys next time.